Welcome to Crossway today. Please join us as we worship God and hear His word.
Majestic is your name in all the earth. Lord our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. The heavens declare your greatness, the oceans cry out to you, the mountains they bow down before you. So I join in the earth and I sing.
To worship you this morning.
I will worship you.
I will worship.
I will worship you.
I will worship. I'll worship.
I will worship you.
I will worship.
I will worship.
Sing, everyone sing.
Together we sing.
Everyone sing.
Everyone sing. And there's none that compares. go before. You are the last, Lord, you're the encore. Your name's in lights for all to see. The starry host declare your glory.
We say to you today, glory in the highest. Glory in the highest.
Tonight we're going to continue our series on squad goals, hashtag squad goals, where we've been talking about what does it look like to be spiritual family? What does it look like to cultivate relationships and family in such a way that this idea of being together actually makes sense? And probably not just makes sense up here, but actually makes sense in the way that we live our lives. And so Andy last week spoke about what does it take for us to build relationships? What's it actually take to kind of connect? And he identified those two things, acceptance and commitment. Acceptance and commitment. These are the frontline approaches that we need to take. These are the frontline characteristics that we want to represent if we're to connect well with spiritual family. Well, tonight I want to take this to the next level. I want to take this to the next level in such a way because if acceptance and commitment is about how we start spiritual family, tonight I want to talk about the two factors that help us sustain spiritual family. What allows spiritual family to keep on going? You know, when I think about our family and when I think about the whole idea of making family, often we think about this idea of defining family as those we share blood with. You know, these are the people I share blood with. This is my brother. This is my sister. These are my parents. But I think there's something absolutely profound that we see in Scripture around what it means to define family, not just who we share blood with, but who we shed blood with. Not just who we share blood with, but who we shed blood with. Because we are a community that's defined by shed blood. And that's what we're actually going to talk about a little bit later on. But first, I want to talk about the waiting game. Now, I grew up in the church. My parents came to faith when I was pretty much born. So they were first-generation Christians. But I remember my experience at church. And if you grew up in church, I'm sure you've experienced this as well. And for those who haven't grown up in church, I'm sure you'll resonate with this in your own way. It's almost like I feel like parents caught a disease when they went to church, where suddenly they just, after the service, want to talk. And it's like there was this incredible amount of talking that would take place after the service that was disproportionate from the amount of talking they did the rest of the week. And so you go to the service and the service would, you know, be an hour and 10 minutes. And then as a kid, I'd be waiting and go, all right, it's time to go home. Where are my parents? It was like the opposite to the shopping center thing. Not like, where's my kids? It's like, where are my parents? And they'd be talking and talking and talking and you play the waiting game. I'm standing around waiting for family. And I was thinking about this standing around process, and even as we were producing this series and thinking through this series, I actually had this image that dropped into my mind of just waiting at a bus stop. Have you ever waited at a bus stop and hoped the bus comes? You know, and somebody might come and kind of stand next to you and you don't really know them, but okay, they're here for the same purpose as me. And I just wonder sometimes when it comes to spiritual family, what it means to kind of do life together. Sometimes I feel we've positioned ourselves too often as people just kind of standing at a bus stop, or waiting for our parents, and just kind of hoping that family forms around us. It's like if enough people come and join me at the bus stop, we'll be able to kind of share stories on bus experiences. And yet, when we look at the life of Jesus, and not just his works, what he did, and not just his words, what he said, but when we actually look at his way, the way that he went about doing life, we see something profound when it comes to how he created spiritual family. And so I want to kind of tap into that tonight. And look at how Jesus went about creating spiritual family, how he went about sustaining spiritual family, and what that actually means for us. And I warn you in advance, this is going to be a bit of a challenging message. Fun, but challenging. Because we can't just end up waiting at a bus stop. Family doesn't form if we just stay passive. Jesus' way is proactive. So I invite you to turn with me, if you've got your Bible, to Matthew chapter 4. We're going to start at verse 18. We're going to be dipping into the life of Jesus and his relationship with his disciples over the course of this sermon. But Matthew chapter 14 is where we're starting. Now, to set up some context, Jesus has obviously been called into ministry. He's been baptized by John the Baptist. There was a sense of like, there was this vision, there was this purpose that Jesus had on his life. And that was really clear. And then he went into the desert and he was tempted by the devil, and this was this opportunity for the devil to try and get under his skin, try to make him doubt the vision and the purpose that God had given him. And yet Jesus was able to kind of stand firm. And so what we see next is Jesus building a team. Now, I just want to put this out there. This is a little side issue. Sometimes God stirs a vision in our heart and we're like, I really want to do that. I really feel like God is calling me to serve these people, to respond to this problem. And you know what we do, and this is particularly prevalent in Western society. We get a vision and we say, I'm going to run with this. I'm going to do something with it and hopefully people come and join me. That's actually our regular approach. It's like, God's given me this vision. I'm just going to do it and hopefully people come alongside me. But that's not what we see in the Bible at all. What we see in the life of Jesus and in the life of a number of people all throughout the Bible is that God gives a vision and the next step is to build team, to build spiritual family, to then step out into mission. And this is exactly what we see Jesus do. So this is where Jesus is positioning. He's like, I need spiritual family. I want to invest in people. I don't want to do this vision alone. And so we read in Matthew chapter 4, verse 18, it says this, as Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Jesus said, come follow me, and I will send you out to fish for people. Note these words. At once they left their nets and followed him. At once they left their nets and followed him. Verse 21, going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee preparing their nets. And Jesus called them, and once again, immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. I can just picture poor Zebedee in the boat, you know, preparing the nets. And she's like, where are you going? Never saw him again. I don't know exactly how that story ends. You know, whenever I think about this scene of Jesus calling his disciples, I recall this, I think it was a Jesus movie I saw. Now, I know there's a number of them out there, but the one I remember is the one where Jesus is in the white flowing robes, and it's almost like he's won Miss Universe because he has that sash kind of going on, and he's looking very good, and he has an American accent, and I just remember the scene. I don't know why I remember this scene, but I always remember he has a stone in his hand, and this is the coolest Jesus ever, and he flicks it along the lake and goes, come follow me. I don't know. Has anyone else seen that version of the Jesus movie? It's like he's just kind of, oh, I'm just walking along the beach. He's just like flicking a stone. Come follow me. I'm sure that's not how it went down. But for some reason, I've always got this American or maybe like Swedish sash supermodel Jesus kind of like calling his disciples. But clearly this is not what was going on. I mean, maybe that's why they followed him. Maybe he looked that good, but probably not the case. Now, what we do know about this situation is that Jesus was a rabbi, okay? So Jesus was a teacher. Now, what was fascinating about this is that usually the approach within the tradition of teaching and the teaching of the rabbis is what would happen is the education system was formed around the Torah, learning the Bible. And the best of the best would basically come and approach a rabbi whose interpretations resonated with their own, and they would approach the rabbi and try to essentially apply to be that rabbi's disciple. And this was a big deal. The rabbi would grill them and he'd ask questions because basically he wanted to know, can these people do what I do? Because it's not just about my words, it's not just about my works, but it's about the way that I do life. And yet this is a profoundly different picture. This is Jesus walking along the Sea of Galilee, seeing some people and saying, come follow me. Now this was an incredible honor, something reserved for the best of the best. And yet Jesus was calling these fishermen out to this incredible privilege, this incredible opportunity. He's saying, come follow me. And so if you ever kind of wondered like I did why they just immediately dropped their nets and kind of went with him, it was for this reason. Jesus was inviting them into an absolute adventure. There was something profound that just took place in their life, and it was this moment, this turning point. It's like, stuff you, Zebedee, we're going this way. And so there was this sense in which it's like Jesus was inviting them into this adventure. And so Jesus, as you can see from his approach, he wasn't just waiting for his disciples to approach him or these potential trainees. He was actually seeking them out. We don't wait, but we create spiritual family. Now, I don't know if we've got rabbis in the house. Maybe you do. Very welcome. But even so, we ought to learn from Jesus' approach. He seeks out spiritual family. He says, I want you. I want you to be part of what is going on here. God's given me a vision. We've got a purpose. It's going to be shared. And I want you. Come in. And so these disciples would have been thrilled. It was an honor and an adventure. And I'm reminded of the words that Andy shared last week around in John 15, 15. Jesus said, you know, I chose you. You didn't choose me, but I chose you. And there's this sense in which all of this spiritual family, when we think about squad goals, when we think about what it means to live as church, it isn't just waiting at a bus stop, hoping good people form around us with a shared vision. There's this sense in which God has called us to something and we're wanting to pursue and say, I'm willing to invest in you guys. I want you to join me in this journey. And who knows what might take place. And the adventure stirs because suddenly you're part of something bigger than yourself. I wonder what God has placed within you that he's actually inviting you to steward, to actually take care of, to invite other people into. Because there's something kind of proactive about this. There's something profound about this. Because it's very easy to wait for spiritual family. If I attend enough services, maybe I will become part of the club. But it doesn't work that way. Jesus demonstrates a different way, even in his own context and culture, for the time that he was there. And so with this in mind, this way of Jesus, which is to invite people into this spiritual family, come join me in what I'm doing. It'll be an adventure. I want to tap into two things that can help sustain spiritual family. Can you imagine the life of these disciples? They thought they were going to catch fish, and now profound things are happening. Miracles are happening. They're being sent out. Jesus is speaking these words of truth that are resonating with people. Crowds are following. And so there was this adventure that was going on. And what we see actually in the life of Jesus is there's these kind of two principles that we can embrace today to help sustain spiritual family. And they're simply this. Number one, and this is the funny thing about it. When I talked about shed blood, you know, shed blood, I feel like there's two ways that we usually shed blood. Number one is through play. We get aggressive, we get competitive, and we just try and do something kind of fun, and usually we end up kind of on the concrete with our face slammed on the ground, or I tried to do a kickflip on my skateboard and totally didn't land it, or whatever it is. Play has this way of generating shed blood. And the second one, actually, I'm going to talk about a little later, is sacrifice. Sacrifice is another way that we shed blood. When we take the hit for another person. When we step in front of another in order that they might not experience the pain. But first I want to talk about play. And to be honest, this is something that is so on my radar right now. So I just want to speak from just my gut. Because play is something that I just feel like Christians don't do good enough. Now, how about that for a terribly phrased statement? Christians don't do play good enough. I don't know why. I think there's this sense in which it's like if we play, it's almost like we're not doing enough good stuff. I don't know what's in the Christian mentality, but I want to tell you this story of where Jesus took his disciples. This is crazy. Okay, so we're going to jump a little bit further up into Matthew chapter 16. But isn't that perfect timing? Don't you want someone to just yell into the microphone during a sermon? Because he took these disciples, these young guys who were up for an adventure on a field trip to somewhere that you could easily miss if you didn't notice this. So Matthew chapter 16, verse 13 to 18, this is where we're going. It says this, when Jesus, and that's it, along with his disciples, came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say the Son of Man is? Who do people say that I am? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say that I am? I mean, you've seen me. You've been invited into this spiritual family. Who do you say that I am? What have you seen? And Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus said, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, Petros, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Now, we could take that passage and look at that incredible thing that Peter says about Jesus and the Messiah and that identity piece. But I want to note just two areas that probably you didn't even take note of. Now, where were they? Caesarea Philippi. And what does Jesus refer to when he affirms Peter? The gates of Hades. Now, when we look back into Jesus' day, Caesarea Philippi was a very interesting place. So it was built by the Greeks, and basically it was this city that was in front of this big cliff. Now picture this with me. And in this cliff there was a cave, a big cave, which they called the Gates of Hades, or the Gates of Hell. Because those who worshipped there believed that that was where the Baals or the gods would enter and exit hell or Hades, right? So it was this big kind of gap. And early on in Jesus' day, water would flow out of this cavern, out of this cave. And it was only in the 19th century due to some earthquakes that now it actually flows lower than that today. But it was this interesting, fascinating, picturesque place. But it was also a temple or a shrine for some terrible, terrible practices. Because it was built by the Greeks, they had this god named Pan, and this god Pan was part goat and part man. And I kind of don't really want to talk about this, but at the same time I'm going to. There were some weird things kind of going on in the worship of the god Pan. And in fact, the worship of the god Pan, people were kind of getting all sexy with goats and stuff. Is that enough detail? And that was kind of what was going on when they were worshipping this god Pan. And so this place, Caesarea Philippi, was shunned by the rabbis, by the Jewish leaders of the day. In fact, they didn't want you to go anywhere near it because there was all these statues, all this bizarre worship. And so essentially, this was a place of evil. And that's where Jesus took his disciples for a field trip. Like, can you imagine what the disciples must have been thinking? These good Jewish boys who kind of got invited by this rabbi because he was flicking a rock and they were impressed. And they're like, suddenly they're in Caesarea Philippi and they're going, what are we doing here? If Zebedee saw me, I'd be so busted. Like, you know, like, there's this sense in which it's like, Jesus took them into this bizarre place and then suddenly they're having this conversation around who Jesus is. And he says this, in response to Peter's affirmation of his messiahship, he says, I will tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades, that thing that you see there, yeah, next to the freaky people, that gates of Hades, the gates of Hades will not overcome it. And what I love about this, I think it speaks something into the way that Jesus approached life with his spiritual family. Now, I'm not saying go to the most crass places of the world and kind of like go, hey, we're Christians and we're going to talk about Jesus. Maybe God's calling you to do that. And some interpretations suggest that's exactly what Jesus was calling us to do. But there was something about the adventure nature of Jesus, taking his disciples to a place that was completely unexpected and yet teaching them and doing life with them there, that I absolutely love. Because there's something about play, there's something about delight, about experience, about doing something kind of crazy that affirms spiritual family, that actually elevates the value of spiritual family, that sustains relationship. So we, when I say we, Dave and I did something kind of crazy a few weeks ago. Some of you would be aware of this. It got a little bit of social media attention. We called it the Chosen Dozen. And I think I've got a picture on the screen to show you. Now, Dave Houghton and I, we were sitting having some dinner together, and we were just having some schnitz because, you know, it's the Lord's food. And we were like just chatting. We're like, what are we going to do tonight? There's nothing to do in Melbourne. And I said to him, hey, I've got this idea. How about we create this kind of social experiment? And what we'll do is we'll get some gnomes at the time. The idea was to get some gnomes. And we'll write a letter on each gnome that spell out something. And then because we didn't have youth that night, it was a Friday night, we're like, we'll drop them around at youth leaders' houses. And then we'll use your work phone that they don't have the number for to text them and say, congratulations, you're part of the Chosen Dozen. And what they had to do was essentially post on social media a picture of their object and then see if they could work out the code with the other Chosen Dozen people. Now, there were no gnomes. We went to BW and they had no gnomes. So we ended up with toasters. So we ended up with 12 toasters. We just went and bought 12 toasters. You know how hilarious it is to be in Big W at 9 p.m. buying 12 toasters? Like, what are people thinking? They're like, do these guys need toast that much? You know, anyway, and so we're unboxing them all. We're chucking them in the back of the Prado and we're going, this is going to be amazing. We've got permanent markers. We start writing letters and then we set out on our journey to the closest proximity leaders' houses we could find. And what we would do is we go there, we dump a toaster on the porch as best we could, then run back to the car and try to run away as fast as we could. And so there was always this sense of like, oh no, the security lights, Dave's done. And so you'd run away. Anyway, it was just bizarre. You can hear how bizarre this is. You're probably thinking, why is this guy up here? Like, that's so, like what is going on? I want to tell you, it was so fun. It was so fun. I reckon in that moment, Dave and I had never been closer. There's something that brings people together when they're getting chased by security lighting, you know. When you rock up to people's houses that you thought were there but turns out to be a construction site, there's something binding about that. You know, when you run out of people to give stuff to, so you end up just giving three toasters to the one person, there's something binding about that. When somebody calls back the number that you text with trying to work out who you are, there's something scary about that too. And we had this moment of just absolute delight and fun and shared experience that was deeply profound. And we cannot underestimate how much fun can bring family together. And I don't know about you. I just want to be completely frank. Like I said earlier, I just don't think Christians do fun well. You know what we do well? Purpose. We love purpose. And purpose is good, but we just don't get play often. You see what happens? This is a good way to think about it. You know, if you end up with play and you're just kind of like giving away toasters, but no purpose to it, you end up with kind of kindergarten, yeah? It's like pretty much you're just playing all the time. There's not much purpose to it. You're just kind of like, hey, here's some toasters. If you end up with purpose but no play, it kind of feels like you're at a staff meeting. It's kind of like, sorry, Dale. gee, that was a bit of a low punch, wasn't it? Except at Crossway, which they're thrilling. But the classic stuff being where there's like a lot of purpose, but you're not having the best time, you know? And so you kind of end up with this kind of staff feel. And if you've got like low purpose and low play, you're pretty much sleeping. But if you've got high purpose and high play, that is where you build family. That's where family emerges. That's where spiritual family emerges. And so purpose is good and you can have a shared vision, but if you don't play, you're missing a key binding ingredient that we need as Christians, one that Jesus actually exemplified, not just with his bizarre field trips, but with the way he went to parties, and can you imagine the conversations on the road? There was this fun play aspect, and if you look historically even at the way that rabbis interacted, you'd know that they laughed a lot. You knew that they were fun times. So play. Play is important because a happy heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones, as it says in Proverbs 17:22, and was on a big banner at my former church. And I remember that. A happy heart is good medicine. Who needs some good medicine in their spiritual family right now? When you think about who you're in relationship with, who you're doing life with, where is the good medicine coming from? Are you willing to do something a little bit crazy to generate such medicine? And I was remembering thinking about this as I was preparing. I was asking myself the question, how many stories do you have? Because isn't it play and fun that generates some of those stories that you share and they make more fun? How many stories do you have? And you might shed some blood along the way. You might trip over and scrape your knee because the security light came on that you weren't expecting. But there's something there that's life-giving, that's kingdom-saturated in play. So if play is one of these factors that we use to sustain spiritual family, the second one is sacrifice. Sacrifice. And I was chatting with some people today, and I was just thinking, how do we sacrifice for our spiritual family? You know, we know the verses around, you know, no greater love than this, and someone to lay down their life for their friend. And that's good, but if you lay down your life for your friend, you're not here today. So I wanted to talk about somebody who is here to you guys around how we go about doing sacrifice in terms of our spiritual family every single day. When I think about my own life, I think about how many cutlery drawers I have filled helping people move house. I think about the amount of trips that I've taken people to the airport, or perhaps because this is sounding a little bit vain, how many times people have taken me to the airport. And I think about those moments of sacrifice. I look at our youth leaders on a Friday night, giving week after week after week, and not getting a whole lot back a lot of the time. And yet they give, and there's this sacrificial heart. They're willing to put themselves out there in a profound way. And what does that do? It cultivates spiritual family. See, it's not just acceptance and commitment that we need when it comes to being and living and proactively pursuing spiritual family. We need fun and we need sacrifice. And yeah, sometimes it hurts a little bit to go into the city to hang out with a friend when really you'd rather just catch up around the corner. Or maybe it hurts a little bit to give some time to investing in some young people, even though you know you're not going to get a whole lot back from them, at least in that six-year period. But you do it anyway. Because you know that whoever you have around you matters. You're buying in. You're pursuing family rather than just waiting for it to appear around you. You see, comfort comes when we're at a distance. But being comfortable in our own skin is when we make ourselves vulnerable, and we do that through sacrifice. And I'd much rather be comfortable in my own skin than just comfortable. And yet I think that's something that sometimes we just need to be reminded of day by day. You know, the best example of sacrifice we obviously find is in Jesus' life. We read in Titus chapter 2, it says this, "For the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people, Jesus. It teaches us to say no to the ungodliness and worldly passions and to live self-controlled, upright and godly lives in this present age," yeah, this life, "while we wait for the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ." Note this, verse 14, "who gave himself for us," hear that sacrifice, "who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness and to purify for himself a people, sacrifice for a people that are his very own, eager to do what is good." As I mentioned right at the beginning, I think sometimes we forget that we, as a church, are a community formed around shed blood. Around the shed blood that comes through play, but most importantly, around the shed blood that comes through Jesus' sacrifice. We are a community formed around shed blood. That is what creates spiritual family. If right now you're in a position, you're going, "I don't know who my spiritual family are." And I want to hear this right, because we all have a responsibility. If you've been part of this church for a long time and you've got a little bit cozy and you haven't stepped out there, I want you to hear the challenge in this. But I want this also to be a challenge for all of us. The question of, when was the last time you shed blood in the pursuit of creating a spiritual family? When did you last shed blood? Because we are a community formed around shed blood. You know, at the end of this message, I'm going to give people an opportunity to respond and actually commit their lives to Jesus and say, "Yeah, actually, I want to follow Jesus, just as Jesus called his disciples. I want to pursue him." But I also just want us to be reminded of what it looks like to be a spiritual family in this time and in this place. Where is the fun? Where is the sacrifice? What does it look like to be that person who does something a little bit crazy, who steps up out of the shadows and says, "You know what? I'd be willing to sacrifice for even a group of my peers because I want to spiritually invest in them." It might be that you're an older person here and you're kind of thinking, "I don't know what it means to make spiritual family." And you're kind of going, "I know that there are young adults, even within this congregation, who are looking for people, older people in life, to step up, to open up their homes, aka sacrifice, so that spiritual family can be formed. And they're going to have to pursue that, and that's important. But what does it look like for you to pursue spiritual family, to steward the vision and the purpose that God has given you and say, "Yeah, I'm going to open this up and create spiritual family"? Shed blood matters. The blood that we shed for each other and the shed blood that Jesus shed for us, that we might know the freedom and the life and the hope and the victory that comes, that we might become a people, a group, a community of which the gates of hell will not withstand. So let's land this. Let's land this in our own lives. Right now, I want you to consider, who are my spiritual family? Who are my spiritual family? And I know for some of you, I just want to be honest, I know for some of you, you're feeling lonely right now. And you're going, "Well, I don't know who my spiritual family is." Maybe you're here for the first time here at Crossway. And you're looking for that spiritual family. Now, I'm not saying it's all on you. But all I'm saying is that we need to position ourselves to be proactive around making spiritual family. What does it look like to have fun, to play, to sacrifice? There might be some people here right now who are in life groups and you realize that it's been a long time since you had a good laugh in your life group. What does it look like to incorporate play into your life group and shared family experience? So maybe it is that you want to step up. Maybe it is that you need to step up and lead your peers. Maybe it is that you just need to do something crazy. Just buy some toasters. whatever it takes, cultivate spiritual family. Because it's one thing to start and have some good squad goals, but it's another thing to sustain spiritual family. And Jesus demonstrates that to us through play and through sacrifice. So let's just take a moment to reflect. So I invite you just to close your eyes if you're comfortable doing that. That would be great. God, right now, just as Jules spoke earlier about position and posture, God, we position ourselves and we posture ourselves to hear from you. God, I want to pray, Lord, for those people whom right now you're stirring their heart. And maybe this is a word for you right now. It's just a stop waiting. Stop waiting. Stop waiting and start cultivating. God, I want to pray, Lord, for all the different words that you're going to speak over people here tonight who are asking that question, what does it look like to be part of spiritual family and what is my role in it? I want to pray for those people here tonight, God, who are feeling an emptiness or a dryness because while they've had purpose, they're actually feeling dry and kind of burnt out because there hasn't been that play. There hasn't been that delight. And God, I want to pray that you would inspire creative ideas in these people. That they would be able to do something that little bit crazy, to have a laugh, to be comfortable, not just for comfort's sake, but to be comfortable in their own skin. God, that is my prayer, Lord. Would we have integrity in the way that we go about life, God? Could we be real with each other? Not just real with the things that we think that other people find attractive, but be real with the craziness and the zaniness of who you have created us to be. Lord, may those areas in our lives not fall or be hidden under a bowl, but God, may those areas of our lives, those unique part of our lives, be cultivated in such a way that the world can see it and can take delight in it, God. Oh, God, we repent, God. We turn away from those parts of our life where we've let shame or we've let fear get in the way of what you want to do in us, what you want to do through us, the invitations you want us to extend. And so, God, whatever kind of work you need to do in our hearts, whatever kind of name right now you are bringing to mind, and it might be that God's bringing a name to mind right now of someone you need to reach out to and say, actually, I want to invite you to be part of my spiritual family. You don't have to use that language. That's kind of creepy, but you can say whatever you want. Invite you to be part of my life. God, may those names, God, stick in hearts in such a way that they cannot be ignored. Right now, I also just want to provide an opportunity. If you've never actually put your trust in Jesus, I just want to provide an opportunity for you to do that. Putting your trust in Jesus should be a simple thing in many respects. Simply saying, I'm not going to live my life according to my own way anymore, but I'm going to live the life that Jesus created me to live his way. And not only that, I'm going to accept his forgiveness for all the ways that I've lived my own way, for all the chaos that I've created in my world and in the worlds of others. God, would you take that? Because through your sacrifice, you wash me clean. You see me as whole. And so if that's you, I'm not going to drag this out at all, but maybe it's here, you're here and you've never actually put your trust in Jesus, but something stirred within you tonight. And you're like, actually, I need to take that step. So if that's you, I'm just going to do the classic kind of count to three. And if on three, you want to actually put your trust in Jesus and you just want to, I'd love to be able to pray for you and to be able to acknowledge that. And all I'm asking you to do is just lift up your hand and give me a wave. And while everyone else is praying and they're kind of filling this space with prayer, I just want to ask, is there anyone right now who you're like, actually, you know what? I've got to put my trust in Jesus. That's the step I've got to take before I cultivate spiritual family. So here we go. One, two, three. If there's anyone here tonight who you want me to pray for you, and if you want to just kind of commit your life to Jesus and say, actually, I'm choosing his way, just raise your hand, just give me a wave. I'd love to pray with you. It might be that God's prompting something in your heart tonight and you've been on the fence for a while and you're saying, actually.
stood before creation, eternity in your hands. You spoke the earth into motion, my soul now to stand. Stood before my failure and carried the cross for my shame. My sin weighed upon your shoulders, my soul now to stand. So what could I say? What could I do? But offer this heart, oh God, completely to you. So I'll walk upon salvation. Your spirit.
Oh,
soul, Lord, to you surrendered all I am is yours. So what could I say? What could I do? But offer this.
Thank you for joining us today. To help support the cost of producing this weekly radio program, send your donation to Crossway Radio Ministry, 2 Vision Drive, Burwood East, Vic 3151. For more information about Crossway, visit us on the web at crossway.org.au.
What could I do? But offer this heart of